to the guitar. Since the beginning, he had routed the strap around his neck, down under the guitar, and then clipped it onto the bottom of the rim of the sound hole, mariachi style. But years of playing had led to a large knot on his neck where his trademark red, white, and blue macrame strap had rubbed. Willie wanted to try a normal strap, which meant putting a button on the side of the heel of Trigger's neck. Earl Wine obliged, with predictable results. Willie hated it. "It changed the whole balance of the guitar," says Tom Hawkins. "He did it for one day, then went back to the old way." At the end of every checkup, Earl Wine puts on a new set of strings, strums the guitar, and marvels again at how sweet Trigger sounds. A guitar sounds better as it gets older, just like a Stradivarius does. The wood ages, and the tone gets more lively. "New guitars have to have time to open up," says Earl Wine. "The wood has to vibrate. It has to move to bring the sound out. Willie plays so much, it's brought out the tone of the guitar." For years, Willie's crew tried to get him to toggle over to another guitar, or to at least give Trigger a break. In the mid-90s, Hootie found a 1968 N20 that was in much better condition. Willie tried it, thanked him, and put it back in its case. In 1998, Martin made an N20 replica, calling it the limited edition signature N20WN, in Willie's honor. Willie tried one, thanked them, and put it back in its case. His loyalty is legendary, as is his dislike of change. At this point, he's simply not going to play another guitar. "Every guitar has its own feel and sound," Willie says. "The Trigger replicas are nice guitars, but anyone who has played this guitar can tell you immediately that there's a different feel." Why is that?
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Magazine, followed by Travelin' Texas at 4.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 86 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
It's in Texas. It's in Texas Monthly. Howdy. Welcome to our program. I'm KC Job, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine. In the sound broadcasting, and our first article will be from our June issue. It's in the state. This is the section News and Politics. It's a dispatch by Eric Benson. Column this month entitled, "The Fauci of South Texas." Laredo cardiologist Ricardo Cigaroa is on the front lines of the COVID-19 crisis, making house calls and dealing hard doses of truth. On a humid and breezy late April morning in the border city of Laredo, Ricardo Cigaroa, a 61-year-old cardiologist, pulled out of his driveway in a 1999 Toyota Tacoma that he christened COVID-mobile and set out to check on self-quarantined patients. Cigaroa knew that some of the house calls that morning would require making life and death decisions. Early in his rounds, he parked his truck in front of a South Laredo mobile home, donned a fresh N95 mask, gloves, a gown, and cheek coverings, and knocked on the door. A middle-aged woman inside had called his office to say that she had tested positive for COVID-19 and was now experiencing shortness of breath. Cigaroa greeted her briskly, checked her oxygen level with the pulse oximeter. It was below 92%, the threshold of hospitalization. He needed to get more extensive care immediately, or her condition would likely deteriorate. Within a few minutes, Cigaroa had dressed in her personal protective equipment, escorted her to the passenger seat of the COVID-mobile, and started driving to the larger of the city's two emergency hospitals, Laredo Medical Center, where Cigaroa often admits his patients. Other visits that morning required emotional tact as much as rapid medical assessment. Figueroa stopped at the house of a local nurse and found a patient who didn't look sick at all. 2 weeks earlier, she'd tested positive for COVID-19 and dutifully isolated herself at home. Her symptoms improved. She had corona light, Figueroa told me. When she was tested again to see if she could go back to work, the results showed that she still had the virus. Now she just wanted to see her husband and two children. Figueroa told her what she already knew. She'd need to stay quarantined for at least another week. She was quite emotional about it, Figueroa said. I visited with her for about 45 minutes. I told her that unfortunately we just have to take it as it comes. We have to be realistic. Remember, you don't have COVID pneumonia. You're not in the ICU. You're not on a ventilator. All those things are phenomenal. Figueroa has about 50 COVID-19 patients he sees in their homes, and they represent a cross-section of the heavily Latino city of some 275,000. Sick middle-class nurses whom he's known for years, low-income South Laredo residents who saw him talking about COVID-19 on the local news or caught his Figueroa Clinic ad in the Laredo Morning Times. Figueroa speaks Spanish during most of his visits and estimates that 60% of his patients don't have health insurance, but he can't know for sure because he doesn't bill anyone for house calls. Most refer to him as Dr. Ricky. It's remarkable how beautiful a house call is, Figueroa said. You walk into somebody's home, immediately you see their world. You know so much about them, their social status, who they live with, the stress of the husband or the wife. You see the children not being able to interact. You see the solitude of the patients. And it gives the patients a great sense of relief that they're not alone. When the pandemic began, Figueroa found himself with time all of a sudden. His cardiology patients were postponing non-emergency visits, so he pivoted his practice to addressing COVID-19. For the first time in his career, he started making regular house calls. Then, when the doctor in charge of the Laredo Medical Center critical care fell ill with the virus, Figueroa took on a more central role in the hospital's COVID-19 intensive care unit, making rounds with patients, strategizing with the hospital's other doctors about treatment methods, and breaking the news to families when their loved ones died. But Figueroa's work during the COVID-19 crisis has not been strictly medical. Starting in early April, in a series of television appearances on Telemundo and a local NBC affiliate, KGNS, Figueroa established himself as a kind of Dr. Fauci of South Texas, dealing hard doses of truth. In the words of Sergio Mora, the host of the Laredo-based podcast Frontera Radio, bespectacled with flowing white hair and a calming, deliberately paced baritone, Figueroa has seized his platform to deliver stark warnings, challenge local health officials, and offer up firsthand stories from the COVID ward at a time when reliable information has felt hard to come by and Laredoans have paid attention. We can't trust no one anymore, Priscilla Villarreal, an influential Laredo tabloid news reporter who goes by the moniker La Gordiloca, wrote to her 166,000 Facebook followers. It seems to me that the only one being straightforward with us is Dr. Figueroa. In March, during the chaotic and confusing early weeks of the crisis, when local and national leaders from both parties waffled over how to respond, Laredo distinguished itself by acting quickly and decisively. Local officials knew that the city was vulnerable, has higher rates of poverty, obesity, diabetes, and uninsured residents than the state and national averages, and it is one of the country's busiest ports, a nexus of trade and human migration through which as many as 100,000 pedestrian, motorists, truck drivers, and bus passengers cross each day, going north and south. We recognized that we're the first line of defense for disease coming in from Mexico, and we're the first line of protection for trade continuing in the United States, Marte Martinez, a physician who serves on Laredo City Council, told me. If our port were to fail, our ability to supply the country would be severely damaged. Martinez and his colleagues acted early. At an emergency meeting on the evening of March 17th, council members voted to pass a stay-at-home order, then the strongest measure in the state. 4 days later, they closed public parks. March 31st, as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention publicly debated about whether to reverse course and advise Americans to wear masks, Council members enacted the first mandatory mask policy in the nation. Violations punishable by a $1,000 fine. After there were reports of police breaking up backyard parties, the council also put into place a strict 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew for all residents. But Laredo's coronavirus response has been far from frictionless. A local freestanding emergency room brokered a deal in March to buy 20,000 badly needed COVID-19 tests from a Chinese medical company. Tests turned out to be duds. City's health authority, Dr. Victor Trevino, told a newscaster that Laredo had probably experienced its first COVID-19 death. Then he publicly backtracked later that night after the death turned out to be unrelated to the coronavirus. But soon, Laredoans actually did start to die from the disease. By early April, 6 residents in 7 days had succumbed to COVID-19. Suddenly, Webb County, home to Laredo, had one of the highest death tolls in the state, with as many coronavirus-related fatalities as Travis County, which has 5 times the population. Still, in daily media briefings, city officials told Laredoans not to panic, emphasizing the number of patients who had recovered and the fact that all of the dead had pre-existing conditions. Figueroa was frustrated by the official response. It seemed very obvious. We weren't conveying the message effectively enough, he told me. He had enough clout to have his opinion heard. Educated at Princeton, Harvard, Figueroa hails from one of Texas's great medical dynasties. His father and uncle, Joaquin and Leonides, both doctors, led the effort to bring what is now Texas A&M International University to the city. His older brother, Francisco, a pediatric transplant surgeon, served as chancellor of the University of Texas system. Figueroa formerly headed the Laredo Medical Group, and in 2003 was named Mr. South Texas, a prestigious Laredo civic honor, along with Francisco. In early March of this year, Laredo Congressman Henry Cuellar leaned heavily on Figueroa, who endorsed him in campaign ads that aired during the final days of Cuellar's tough primary race against progressive challenger Jessica Cisneros. Now Figueroa chose to leverage his reputation to urge Laredoans to take the pandemic more seriously. The low number of positive tests was due mostly to a lack of testing, he thought. Physicians who were actively taking care of patients, they were saying, my gosh, we have a lot of patients with COVID. We're having more upper respiratory infections that we're seeing, Figueroa said. The sense of urgency in the city's daily briefings wasn't there. On April 6th, Figueroa appeared on the KGNS nightly news broadcast and calmly talked anchor Jerry Garza through the history of pandemics, the city's horrifying prospects, and worst-case scenario. Laredo had a total of 68 ICU beds when more than 1,000 could be needed, and the danger Laredoans faced if they defied stay-at-home orders. What would you do if there was a sniper across the street on top of the roof, Figueroa said. Would you allow your child, your son, your daughter, your parents to walk out of the house? I don't think you would. And the virus is everywhere. It's on top of every house. Interview was widely viewed and shared on social media. A few days later, Figueroa's daughter, Alyssa, a painter who helped run a local arts organization, decided to start a Facebook page, Laredo Contra COVID-19, with a similar goal, to give Laredoans an unfiltered look at what was happening on the city's medical front lines. On Monday, April 13th, Laredo Contra COVID-19 posted a video featuring a local ER doctor ill with COVID-19 who warned, we are losing nurses and doctors very quickly. It was viewed 40,000 times within a few hours. That afternoon, Dr. Hector Gonzalez, the director of the city's health department, addressed the severity of the outbreak in Laredo's medical community. Over 12 healthcare providers had tested positive, Gonzalez said, and none were hospitalized. Figueroa knew this number was off. He made some calls to get a more realistic tally, and then he released a statement through Laredo Contra COVID-19. Not 12, but more than 50 healthcare workers had been infected, and several were critically ill. Everyone is trying their best, Figueroa wrote, but we must be accurate. Figueroa's statement had a quick and dramatic effect. The next day, Gonzalez acknowledged at a press briefing that Figueroa's number was correct. Gonzalez told Texas Monthly that the discrepancy was because cases were still under investigation by his staff. That evening, Figueroa appeared on newscasts speaking English and Spanish, to discuss what the city's medical workers were seeing. By the end of the week, Laredo Medical Center, where most of the infected healthcare providers worked, announced that 64 staff members had tested positive for COVID-19, accounting for 20% of the city's overall cases. That Friday, the Texas Department of State Health Services dispatched a team to investigate the outbreak. 2 weeks later, on May 1st, the city reported that Laredo Medical Center now had 96 staffers and contractors who had tested positive. When Governor Greg Abbott ordered a partial phased reopening of the state to begin May 1st, he preempted local orders, including Laredo's. After issuing 354 citations for mask violations, Laredo could no longer fine citizens for not covering their noses and mouths, and restaurants were welcome to open their doors with limited capacity, just as they were in every other municipality in the state, from tiny towns with no known cases to big cities with thousands of infections. George Altgelt, the city council member who had pushed most intensely for the city's mitigation measures, told me that the state and federal government didn't really understand the predicament of his border town. Are we really left to fend for ourselves, but with their rules and little to no support? Altgelt said. Still, by that point, the data looked favorable for Laredo. New cases of COVID-19 were declining, likely due at least in part to the city's aggressive measures. Even Sigueroa, who believes there are 10 times more cases than the testing numbers indicate, said he thought that the public health situation was manageable. Sigueroa also warned against complacency. He said the state was risking a second wave by opening too quickly. The virus was still a sniper on top of every house. At Laredo Medical Center, Sigueroa had seen 4 patients die over 5 days at the end of April. He and his colleagues felt powerless. You start wondering, what are we doing, he said. Sigueroa had emphasized again and again that there was no cure or even helpful treatment for COVID-19. And on April 30th, the night before the state began to reopen, he was back on Jerry Garza's show to reiterate just how bad the disease could get. He brought along 2 CT scans. The first showed a healthy person's clear lungs. The second scan, taken 10 days after one of his patients first started experiencing COVID-19 symptoms, was a horrifying image of an infection colonizing a human organ. He wanted Laredoans to understand the tremendous destruction the virus could inflict. He hoped that if they stood in his shoes for just a few moments, might make better decisions in the consequential weeks to come. People say, well, doctor, you're a lot more serious than most other people, Sigueroa said. I am, because I have to deal with this. I see it. I see it daily. Next up, we're going to read this feature article. Starts out, 5 judges, 5 representatives, and the district attorney says she was wrongly convicted. When a child she was babysitting choked to death, she was the only suspect. Now many believe the child's death was an accident, but not the attorney general. It's by Michael Hall. Title of the article, so why is Rosa Jimenez dying in prison? First came the sound of someone running hard on the breezeway outside, then a banging on the apartment door. Irene Vera opened it to see her neighbor, 20-year-old Rosa Jimenez, holding a little boy who lay limp in her arms. Help me, Jimenez cried hysterically in Spanish. The boy, she said, had choked on something he had swallowed. Brian Gutierrez was only 21 months old, and Vera took him and lay him on the floor, then stuck her finger in his mouth, trying to find whatever might be there. Brian kept biting down, though, so she stopped. When another neighbor showed up, Vera yelled at her to call 911. Jimenez, Brian's babysitter, stood to the side, sobbing. Mio, she said through tears, what's wrong, what's wrong? It was 1:30 in the afternoon on January 30th, 2003, and the police arrived shortly thereafter at the Sam Rayburn Apartments in a rundown North Austin neighborhood. An officer tried CPR on Brian, who had no pulse. Paramedics showed up and tried to resuscitate him, injecting drugs to get his heart working again. A firefighter placed a bag valve mask over the boy's mouth and fruitlessly tried to pump air in. Something was blocking the airway. Finally, one of the paramedics reached deep inside Brian's throat with forceps and pulled out a large, bloody mass of paper towels. It was, as another paramedic later described it, the size of a large egg. Brian was rushed to Children's Hospital of Austin and put on a ventilator, but by then the lack of oxygen had rendered him brain dead. The size of the wad of paper towels became a prime topic of conversation among the paramedics, ER doctors, and police officers. There was no way, many of them agreed, that a toddler could afford something that large, that far down his own throat. Meanwhile, back at Jimenez's apartment, police officers found a roll of paper towels on the couch and some traces of blood in the bathroom. The police needed to know exactly what happened to Brian, so by mid-afternoon, one of them asked Jimenez if she would go to the station to answer some questions. Once there, Jimenez, who was 5'2" tall with a girlish face and long black hair, sat down with a bilingual officer, Eric De Los Santos, and gave him some of her background. She came to the United States for the same reason many Mexicans do, to earn money to send back home. Jimenez had been born in 1982 in Ecatepec, a large suburb of Mexico City, and grew up poor, the middle child of five. She never knew her father, and her mother sold tamales from a small pushcart. When Jimenez was 17, she dropped out of school and headed north, illegally crossing the Rio Grande and making her way to Austin, where she knew a couple of people. She didn't speak English and struggled to find work and even considered returning home until she met a young man named Fidel Juarez, who was her roommate's husband's cousin. The two began dating, and by early 2003, they had a year-old daughter, Brenda, and a son on the way. Jimenez, 7 months pregnant, told Officer De Los Santos that Juarez worked for a roofing company while she stayed home and took care of Brenda. For the previous 7 months, 2 or 3 days a week, she had also been caring for Brian, whose mother was in the country illegally too, and paid Jimenez $12 for 5 or 6 hours. After Brian was dropped off that morning at 9, Jimenez told De Los Santos the boy and Brenda napped, then they got up and played and watched cartoons. Both kids had colds, and at one point, Jimenez grabbed a roll of paper towels, tore one off, and wiped their noses with it. Soon, Brian and Brenda were ripping off pieces of the towels, white with blue and pink butterflies, and throwing them. Jimenez told them to stop. Then, while the kids played and watched TV, she cooked lunch. Soon after that, Jimenez said she saw Brian walking slowly toward her, his hand at his throat. Jimenez realized he was choking, so she grabbed him and ran to the bathroom, where she slapped him on the back and tried to open his mouth. He bit down. Panicking, she picked him up and ran to her neighbor, Veta, for help. "I love him as if he were my son," she told De Los Santos. The officer pressed her for more information about how Brian had gotten a paper lodged in his throat. Like the emergency responders, he figured a small child couldn't have done it by himself. Jimenez said she didn't know how he did it. Soon, De Los Santos was suggesting otherwise. "You wanted some moments of peace," he said, "and you put the towel inside his mouth." "No," she replied. The officer offered a theory. She had done this because she was angry with Brian. She insisted she was not. He pushed the idea again and then again. More than 20 times, De Los Santos either asked her if she had been angry or declared that she was. "No," she responded. "Not even a little bit?" "I'm sure I did not get angry. With everything that's happening, you want to cook, want to clean, the children are fighting. Well, I do that every day." The interview grew more and more intense, but Jimenez didn't waver. "I haven't done anything bad," she insisted. Finally, after more than 5 hours of questioning, De Los Santos took Jimenez home. At around 11 p.m., she was arrested. Charge: injury to a child, a first-degree felony punishable by as many as 99 years in prison. Was no physical evidence directly tying her to a crime. Brian showed no signs of any other trauma that would indicate an assault, such as bruises or cuts on his mouth, lips, and cheek. And Jimenez had no criminal record or history of physical abuse or substance abuse. Yet when Brian died 3 months later, Jimenez was also indicted for murder. By the time of her 2005 trial, she'd become one of the most notorious defendants in modern Austin history, babysitter accused of an almost unspeakable act of violence. When Jimenez was convicted and sentenced to 99 years, prosecutor Allison Wetzel spoke of justice delivered. This is the kind of sentence that's appropriate when someone murders a child. But had Rosa Jimenez murdered a child? Had she even committed a crime? Jimenez had always claimed she was innocent, and in the years after her conviction, as her case wound through the appellate courts, began to gain champions who believed her, from pro bono lawyers and documentary filmmaker to the president of Mexico. Most notable were four American judges who either pronounced that her first trial had been constitutionally unfair or expressed grave doubts about the verdict. Unfortunately for Jimenez, each time she was awarded a new trial, the state of Texas argued that she didn't deserve one. For a decade, the conflict raged, and it finally appeared to be coming to a head this year. Federal District Judge Lee Yackel gave the Texas Attorney General's office a deadline of February 25, 2020. Either set Jimenez free, Yackel wrote, or retry her. On the morning of January 14, 2020, almost 17 years after little Brian was rushed to the hospital, U.S. Magistrate Judge Andrew Austin held a hearing on the Jimenez case. The Office of Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, which handles appeals when state criminal cases move into the federal courts, wanted to cancel the deadline and allow the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals time to pass judgment on whether Jimenez deserved a new trial, which could take another year or two to decide. Judge Austin, who had already weighed in on the Jimenez case once, writing that justice and fundamental fairness require that she get a new trial, grew increasingly frustrated as he listened to the arguments. For 20 minutes, the judge, wearing a long black robe and a stern countenance, grilled the Attorney General's lawyers as well as a team from the Travis County District Attorney's Office, which had originally prosecuted the case. And then he snapped. "Sit down," Austin barked at a member of the AG's staff who had been addressing him. "Sit down. I mean, come on. Really?" He sighed loudly. Federal judges rarely express their feelings about the innocence of a petitioner before the court, but as the hearing neared its end, Judge Austin, who had been on the federal bench for 20 years, grew more and more plain-spoken about his feelings on Jimenez's position. He cited the opinions of four judges, including himself, who questioned the original trial's fairness. All four, he said, think this is a very infirm trial and that there is likely an innocent woman who is sitting in a jail for 17 years. Austin was especially concerned because of what he called Jimenez's medical issues. She had recently been diagnosed with stage 4 chronic kidney disease, making her spend another year or more in prison while the higher court deliberated would lead, Austin said, to irreparable harm. In the words of one of Jimenez's lawyers, Vanessa Potkin, we are fearful that this life sentence is going to turn into a death sentence for her. This is not a normal case, Austin concluded. It's distressing to me that we're just treating this like it's just an average case and we're just going to kind of go through the motions. State of Texas versus Rosa Estela Olvera Jimenez is definitely not a normal case, and it would get even stranger in the months after the hearing. District Attorney Margaret Moore would eventually cross over to Jimenez's side and contend that the inmate did not get a fair trial. If you believe Moore, Judge Austin and the other dissenting judges, a fifth one recently joined them, this is one of those rare cases that shows how the processes the criminal justice system relies on don't always deliver justice, even when everyone does things mostly by the book. It's not that anyone involved in Jimenez's case acted in bad faith, as is common in wrongful convictions. No law enforcement officers botched the investigation. No prosecutors hid evidence. No witnesses lied on the stand. Everyone worked within the rules, though some did so more effectively than others. Over the years, both sides have made legitimate arguments about why Jimenez's trial was or was not fair. But today, even as the DA herself argues that the trial was flawed, the state attorney general's office continues to fight to preserve a guilty verdict against a defendant who is almost certainly innocent, who has spent nearly half her life behind bars, and who may soon end her days there. It's a natural break point in the story, so it's a good spot to stop. Remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. and listen to Sight and the Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and the Sound Radio since 1967. We return to our story, which is, so why is Rosa Jimenez dying in prison? Like any proceeding involving a dead child, especially one the state claimed had been brutally murdered, the trial of Rosa Jimenez was an intense, heated affair. Prosecution was led by Allison Wetzel, a fierce children's advocate and veteran of the District Attorney's Child Abuse Division. Jimenez's court-appointed lawyer, Leonard Martinez, was known as a passionate defender. During the week-long trial, emotional testimony filled the courtroom of Judge John Wisser. Brian's mother cried as she talked about the death of her only child, an active little boy with big eyes and a wide smile. Jimenez wept as everyone listened to the 911 recording. Pardoned police officers and veteran doctors blinked away tears as they testified and listened to details of the boy's struggle. At one point, Brian's uncle, closest thing the baby had to a father figure, started hyperventilating and had to be carried from the courthouse on a stretcher. The prosecution's case against Jimenez was simple. Because a 21-month-old child couldn't have put a wad of 5 paper towels down his throat, someone else must have done it, and Jimenez was the only adult in the room. The state brought in 4 expert witnesses to make its case. One was the ER doctor, who said the nearly this-sized wad was way beyond what I've ever seen any other kid ingest. The boy's gag reflex would push it out, he said, an opinion shared by the pediatric ICU doctor, who said, there's no way that Brian put this in his mouth all by himself. Brian would have had to have been forcefully held down. She testified, a forensic pathologist said the throat of a child that age is too narrow to take in something like this voluntarily, adding that the physics of it are impossible. A pediatrics and child abuse specialist said about the possibility of Brian's having done it to himself, I don't see how all that can happen. The state also focused on what it portrayed as suspicious things Jimenez had said during the investigation. It made inconsistent statements about how she had found Brian. First, she said he was walking toward her, next that he was on the floor, and then during the interrogation, she had asked De Los Santos if they could talk outside. Sure, he said. This happened just after she had learned that Child Protective Services had taken her daughter, Brenda, from her husband. Once outside, she asked De Los Santos, if I were to tell you that I did it, what would happen? He wasn't sure, he answered, but she'd probably go to prison. He pressed her again to tell what happened, and she replied, I first want to see my daughter. De Los Santos arranged for Brenda to be brought to the police station, where she was held by a caseworker, and Jimenez was allowed to talk to her. After a few minutes, Brenda was taken away. De Los Santos asked her again to tell him when Brian had choked. I can't, she said. The prosecution thought this was highly suspicious, the sign of a manipulative criminal. Martinez, aided by attorneys Catherine Haney and John Evans, countered with a simple case as well. There was no physical proof, such as DNA, that Jimenez had stuffed the paper towels in Brian's mouth. Martinez argued that the various efforts to get the wad out of Brian's mouth and to resuscitate him may have pushed it deeper into his throat. The police officer who tried CPR had never performed it before. As for Jimenez's inconsistent statements, Martinez said they were the result of her panic. Her question to De Los Santos about what could happen to her was a sign of her desperation to see her daughter. Her first question to the officer when they got outside was, why did they take the little girl from my husband? Several character witnesses, including a mother whose kids Jimenez had babysat, used words like peaceful and loving to describe Jimenez. No one had ever seen her get angry. To counter the state's experts, Martinez brought in a Connecticut medical examiner named Ira Kantfer. Martinez had tried to get others, especially experts who had pediatric training or who knew something about choking, but they refused. One, because he felt the expert witness fee Martinez offered wasn't sufficient, and another because she said she would still owe payment from a previous case in Travis County. Canfer had no pediatric training and little clinical experience, and he wasn't a member of any relevant professional organizations, such as the American Academy of Forensic Scientists. On the stand, he leafed through a series of articles he had printed from the internet on children and choking. He testified that this tragedy was an accident. The lack of trauma on the boy's face proved that. I mean, he said, you get a 2-year-old kid, you try to stuff this thing down their throat, this kid's going to be fighting like hell. He testified that a toddler was absolutely capable of wadding up paper towels and swallowing them, maybe drop them into the commode. The boy liked to throw things there, including, at least once, a roll of toilet paper, making them easy to compress. Canfer held up an empty toilet paper tube and told of an experiment he had done when he wadded up 5 paper towels, soaked them, and they dropped like a wet lead weight right through this tube. Wetzel sharply questioned Canfer about his credentials, pointed out that in a 19-year career he had written only a handful of abstracts, short articles with titles such as Unusual Methods of Suicide in Connecticut and How to Turn a Homicide into an Accident. During a break, an angry Canfer saw Wetzel and assistant DA Gary Cobb in the hallway and told themselves they could go F themselves. Back in court, Wetzel badgered Canfer further about his expertise and wrapped up her questioning by asking about the hallway exchange. At least one juror laughed out loud. Martinez didn't object to Wetzel's question, which most lawyers would have done since it had nothing to do with the case. Wetzel provoked Canfer with the statement again, and finally Martinez pushed back, though he didn't make a motion for a mistrial, as he could have, nor did he do so when Wetzel brought it up a third time. Leonard just sat there, his co-counsel Haney told me. I kept whispering to him, object, object. I thought her questioning was outrageous. Martinez later explained his strategy of rarely objecting against Wetzel. He wanted the jury to hate her, so he gave her a great deal of leeway, as I thought her behavior would alienate a jury. Wetzel made her case to the jury with the same simple logic that had been used to bring Jimenez to trial in the first place. Use your common sense, she implored jurors. A toddler couldn't have done that to himself. Jurors, many of them who had wiped tears from their eyes over the previous week, agreed. When Jimenez heard her 99-year sentence, she stared straight ahead for a few moments as if paralyzed. Finally, she buried her head in her arms and wept. A few weeks later, she was sent to the Lucille Plain State Jail in East Texas. Jimenez would probably have been long forgotten if not for another young Mexican woman whom she had met a year before her sentencing. Lucia Gaja was a Mexico City filmmaker who had made several short documentaries after graduating from film school in 1999. She wanted to make a film about Mexican women in U.S. prisons, how they had left home trying to make new lives for themselves but got caught up in a world they didn't understand, sometimes tragically. In 2004, Gaja got into touch with Carmen Cortez Harms, who worked for the Mexican consulate in Austin as a liaison between Mexican female prisoners and their families. Cortez gave Gaja a list of 21 women behind bars, 20 of whom had already been convicted. Gaja met them and then was introduced to number 21, Jimenez, who was still in the Travis County Correctional Complex awaiting trial. The filmmaker thought Jimenez's case would be a good vehicle for analyzing the U.S. judicial process. It was February 2005, 6 months before Jimenez would go on trial, Gaja got permission to film the inmate in jail and in court. Jimenez told Gaja what she told everyone else. She didn't kill Brian. Gaja didn't know whether to believe her. Jimenez seemed like a nice person. She showed Gaja photos of her husband and children. Her son, Emmanuel, had been born while she was still in jail and taken from her 3 days later, and cried when talking about how much she missed her mother, Estella. She cried, too, when talking about Brian. I don't know how it happened, she said in Spanish. The boy is dead, and that has affected me a lot. It was an accident. Then the trial began, and as Gaja filmed, she was struck by a realization. There was absolutely no physical evidence that Jimenez had killed Brian. Every day, a paramedic, cop, or doctor got up on the stand and insisted the babysitter had stuffed the paper towels in Brian's throat because the boy couldn't have done it himself. All of that, combined with the absence of a motive, a lack of marks on the boy's face, and the fact that Jimenez had no prior criminal or violent history, made Gaja wonder, could Jimenez be telling the truth? By the end of the trial, Gaha felt certain that Jimenez, who didn't speak English and had no money to hire an expensive lawyer or pay for more and more credible experts, had been wrongly accused and convicted, borne along in the emotional aftermath of a helpless child's death. Someone had to be held accountable for Brian's tragic death, she thought, and the obvious person was his babysitter. They thought she was guilty from the start, Gaha told me. From the first day, she didn't stand a chance. Motivated by the sense that she had witnessed a terrible injustice, Gaha returned to Mexico City and began to put the film together, using trial footage to support her theory that well-meaning professionals had been driven by outrage, not fact. There was the young paramedic who worked on Brian and who testified that at first, responders all thought it was an accident until the wad was extracted. It was shocking how large it was, she said. We no longer assumed the scene to be an accident. There was the ICU doctor who had never before encountered a wad of paper towels like this in a child's throat, who was absolutely certain it had been forced there by someone else. The fact that I've never seen it keeps me from sleeping at night, she testified. Gahad shot footage of Prosecutor Wetzel during closing arguments, her voice sometimes choked with emotion. A successful prosecutor will create a compelling narrative of a crime to make her case to a jury, sometimes relying on speculation, and that's exactly what Wetzel did, summarizing the monstrous things that she theorized Jimenez, this child killer, had done. She used a lot of force and she pried his mouth open, Wetzel said. She's holding his face. She's pushing it and pushing it down so far so it will get far down there. Wetzel was relentless with her narrative. She held him down while he struggled. Once he was quiet, she kept pushing. And as his motive she conjectured, she killed him out of anger. Gaha's film flowed from one emotional scene to another, showing in retrospect how easy it was to convict Jimenez. Searching for a way to summarize Jimenez's journey into the U.S. criminal justice system, the director used footage of defense attorney Haney near the end of the film. I think that if this would have happened to somebody in West Austin, a middle, upper-class, educated person, that person probably would not have ended up in the same situation as Rosa, said Haney. I think it was very easy for them because she's Mexican, she's poor, she's illegal, she didn't know her rights. In the interview, if that would have happened to me, after the second time this guy told me I did it, I probably would have used some very ugly words, and I would have asked him, how many times do I need to tell you? I didn't do it. I can't tell you anything else, and I want a lawyer now. Because she was being accused of having done something she didn't do. Anybody who would have known the system better, had more money, more resources, would have been able to put up a much better fight. Gaha's gritty documentary, Mi Vida Dentro, My Life Inside, came out 2 years after the trial and caused a stir in our home country. Viewers couldn't take their eyes off Jimenez, who spoke quietly as tears rolled down her cheeks. The country took away from me what I most love, she said, my children, my husband, my mother, my freedom, my happiness. Everything a woman yearns for, they took away from me in one day. Jimenez came across as warm and open, if still bewildered. Was learning English behind bars and had also discovered a talent for drawing. Her cell was decorated with her artwork as well as cards and letters from her children. The camera focused on a letter Jimenez had just written her mother. Hola, mami, it began. Mi vida dentro struck a nerve among the Mexican viewers, many of whom knew first or second hand how the dream of crossing the border could turn into a nightmare. They wrote outraged letters to the governor of the state of Mexico, which surrounds Mexico City on three sides, as well as the country's president, asking them to do something. A legal defense fund was set up, and activists began hosting fundraisers. At one of them, Jimenez's mother sold tamales. The film was nominated for several awards and won Best Documentary at the Morelia International Film Festival. It had its U.S. premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival. The Mexican government hired a lawyer, Yuriria Marvan, to find a U.S. lawyer who could help Jimenez. The documentary became a symbol of people that go to the U.S., work hard, find themselves in unfair situations, and end up being discriminated against, Marvan told me. Rosa is a mother, a woman. This happened while taking care of another baby. The maternal culture in Mexico is very strong. Marvan brought in Bryce Benjet, an Austin civil lawyer who also worked on death penalty cases. At the time, he was representing death row inmate Rodney Reed, who also claimed innocence and whose case would eventually become internationally known. Ben Jett began calling well-known children hospitals looking for pediatric otolaryngology, ear, nose, and throat experts who knew something about choking. At Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, one of the most renowned in the country, he reached Karen Zur, a surgeon and professor who's also the associate director of the Center for Pediatric Airway Disorders. After looking at the evidence, Zur was adamant. She wrote in an affidavit that it is absolutely possible that the child in this case could have stuffed paper towels in his mouth and then accidentally choked on them. She added that nothing about the size of the obstruction rules out an accidental choking incident. She also explained that the gag reflex doesn't always push something out. Sometimes it can draw an object farther in. Zur's opinion was affirmed by three other pediatric specialists. It is entirely possible and even likely that Brian accidentally placed a large wad of paper towel in his mouth that became lodged in his throat, said an anesthesiologist and critical care doctor. Another pediatric otolaryngologist gave an affidavit in which he told of removing a similar-sized wad of bread from the throat of a 28-month-year-old. A pediatric forensic pathologist who had conducted numerous autopsies on kids, including suffocations, said, "There's nothing unusual or impossible for a child to place a large wad of paper towel in his mouth." She'd seen photos of the wad. The oropharynx of a child Brian's age can accommodate objects of this size even without chewing. The fact that there was no other suspicious injuries on Brian made her think his death was an accident. Pathologist also gave her opinion of the state's experts. She was not impressed. "I was struck by the level of speculation," she wrote. "None of the people who testified spoke to the actual facts of the event. Also, none of the experts in the case had the necessary training and experience or consulted with persons with this specialized knowledge in order to give a reliable opinion. None of the experts referred to the scientific elements supporting their conclusions or the specific physical and anatomical vulnerability of a child this age's airway, which makes accidental choking a leading cause of death." Ben Jett felt he had the tools to free Jimenez. There was no science behind Jimenez's conviction, and the common sense was nonsense, rejected by experienced specialists who all insisted that a toddler could very well have swallowed those paper towels. Jimenez had already had her first appeal denied, but in 2010, Ben Jett filed a writ of habeas corpus, an appeal challenging the basic fairness of the trial. The brief highlighted the opinions of the specialists he consulted with, but the legal claims focused on the ineffectiveness of Jimenez's expert and lawyer. Ira Canfer not only lacked the necessary expertise to talk about what happened to Brian, Ben Jett wrote, but he also self-destructed on the stand. By the end of his testimony, Dr. Canfer had no credibility. The brief also blamed Judge Wisser for not releasing funds for more experts during the original trial. Wisser had funded two other experts, a psychologist and an artist who made an illustration of a child's airway to demonstrate Canfer's theory. Ben Jett saved much of his scorn for Martinez, not only for failing to hire a more competent expert on choking, but also because he didn't object when the prosecution made an issue of Canfer's four-letter word or moved for a mistrial when Canfer fell apart on the stand. State District Judge Charlie Baird called a December hearing and experts from both sides testified. Afterward, he did something appellate judges really do. He threw out the verdict, writing that Jimenez's trial was fatally infected by constitutional error. The move paved the way for a new trial. "Having Canfer as an expert," Baird wrote, "was worse than having no expert at all. In my 30 years as a licensed attorney, 20 years in the judiciary, this court has never seen such unprofessional and biased conduct from any witness, much less from a purported expert." Baird faulted Martinez for hiring Canfer, but also for failing to secure funding for more experts. Like Ben Jett, he also blamed Wisser for not providing the money. For his part, Martinez claimed in an affidavit to the court that, in an informal meeting with Wisser, he'd unsuccessfully asked for more funding. However, because Martinez had made no written record of that request, it couldn't be used later in Jimenez's appeals. Judge Wisser denied the request had been made. Baird capped his opinion by asserting that Jimenez's new pediatric specialist effectively rebutted the state's theory of guilt. When Jimenez heard, she was ecstatic. "It's a miracle," she prayed, thanking God. She thought that because a judge said she deserved a second chance, she would be released any day. But that's not how things work in the criminal justice system. Baird's decision had to be ratified by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the state's highest criminal court. Just 5 years, Jimenez had already seen her case move dramatically through the courts from guilty to deserves a new trial. For 2 years after Baird's judgment in 2012, the CCA overruled him and reversed Jimenez's status back to guilty. Martinez had done an adequate job, the court wrote, and so had Canfer, who had come to the same conclusion as the three newer experts. "The Constitution doesn't require an equivalency of experts," said the court, noting that Ultimately, the credibility of dueling experts is for a jury to decide. Though the opinion was unanimous, Judge Kathy Cochran also quoted a recent Supreme Court decision that seemed to hint at qualms she and other judges felt when reviewing Jimenez's case. As rational people can sometimes disagree, the decision read, judges will sometimes encounter convictions that they believe to be mistaken, but that they must nonetheless uphold. Jimenez is crushed by the decision, and Benjet, now working for the Innocence Project in New York, a New York-based nonprofit that had already helped free nearly 200 wrongly convicted inmates, assured her that the fight wasn't over. He raised her spirits later that year when he told her that Judge Wisser had written an unusual letter to the district attorney at the time, Rosemary Lemberg, sharing his concern about the case. Like others, Wisser noted that Jimenez had no motive and no history of violence. While he thought the trial had been fair, he emphasized that there was an inherent danger of wrongful conviction in cases like this that involved dead children. I believe now, wrote Wisser, as I did at the time of the trial, that there's a substantial likelihood that the defendant was not guilty. Armed with the words of the two judges and the three new experts in 2012, Benjet filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court asserting that Jimenez was denied a fair trial because of bad lawyering. He attached briefs from legal scholars and one from Enrique Peña Nieto, the president-elect of Mexico. Citizens of Mexico and their government leaders have been shocked by Rosa Jimenez's treatment in the Texas criminal justice system, Peña Nieto wrote. Americans would surely be alarmed, and rightly so, if a U.S. citizen received a 99-year sentence in Mexico based on the facts in Rosa's trials and habeas proceedings. The Supreme Court refused to hear the case, leaving Benjet, assisted by Dallas lawyer Sarah Ann Brown, with one final option: a writ of habeas corpus in federal court, where an inmate can appeal the denial of habeas in the state court. It's a high bar to clear. Defense lawyers have to show the state's decision was contrary to federal law or based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence. Federal courts rarely overturn state courts' decisions in such cases. For Benjet and Brown, the issue is the same as it had been in the state habeas proceedings. A poor defendant has a right to a fair trial, including in cases that necessitate expert testimony. Not only was Canfor unqualified to argue, but also the new expert's testimony revealed that state's witnesses had shown a basic misunderstanding of how a child's airway worked. Otolaryngologists, qualified to determine whether an accidental choking was possible. Emergency care doctors who'd used no science, for example, nobody ever measured the boy's throat, were not. The second time in a decade, Benjet's argument found a sympathetic judicial ear. This time it was a magistrate, Judge Austin, who in 2018 wrote a report to Lee Yackel, the federal district judge, finding that Jimenez's attorney had been ineffective and Canfor unqualified. By definition, expert testimony requires expertise, Austin wrote. He recommended that Yackel throw out the verdict and grant a new trial. In October of last year, Yackel did just that, issuing the deadline, February 25, 2020, by which the state needed to release Jimenez or begin new proceedings. The attorney general's office, which had already written that this case is about common sense, not forensics, appealed the deadline. The appeals led to the January 14th hearing in Austin's court, but the whole issue was made moot 3 weeks later when a three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals threw out Yackel's deadline. Now, the full 16-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit would be responsible for deciding whether Jimenez deserved a new trial at all. Once again, Jimenez had to wait for a court to ponder whether to heed a judge who believed she was wrongly convicted. This time, though, the wait threatened more than her freedom. She now suffers from a chronic health issue that has her one step away from kidney failure. If the disease progresses, she will need dialysis and possibly a transplant. Unfortunately for Jimenez, who gets to see a doctor only every 3 months, it's almost impossible for prison inmates to get on a transplant eligibility list. Worse, the condition has compromised her immune system, putting her at greater risk of severe complications if she were to contract the novel coronavirus, which has been marching inexorably through the Texas prison system. When Jimenez came to the United States as an undocumented immigrant, she knew almost no one. Now, convicted of murder, she's made numerous friends, many of whom wrote her sympathetic letters after they saw Mi Vida Dentro. It made her feel good to have strangers believe in her innocence, and she eagerly wrote them back. She's kept it up for more than a decade, and now, housed at the Mountain View Unit in Gatesville, she spends her weekends corresponding with friends as well as drawing and painting watercolors. During the week, she works as a graphic designer for a prison program that puts together Braille textbooks for schools. She started doing the work 2 years ago. I fell in love with it, she told me in English. It's like learning a new language. Sitting in the prison visitor's room, Jimenez looks very much like she did in Mi Vida Dentro, as if preserved under glass all these years. She has a shy but warm manner, brightening with talking about her artwork or her friends. Her English is good, though she sometimes reverts to Spanish pronunciations. Jimenez, who isn't eligible for parole until 2033, speaks every week with her current lawyers, Brown and Vanessa Potkin, of the Innocence Project, who see in her case similarities with others in which women were later exonerated. According to the Innocence Project, most female exonerees were convicted of crimes that turned out not to have been crimes at all. Of these cases, three-quarters involved children, leading to emotional trials in which the defendants were prosecuted on shaky evidence and demonized. In 2007, a case remarkably like Jimenez's went to trial in Corpus Christi after Hannah Overton's 4-year-old foster son died of salt poisoning and she was accused of murder. Like Jimenez, Overton had been interrogated for 5 hours by skeptical policemen. Investigators and prosecution experts thought the death was definitely not an accident, and the prosecutor theorized that Overton committed the murder by forcing the boy to ingest a massive amount of spicy seasoning because she was angry. In words similar to Wetzel's, the prosecutors in Overton's case painted a monstrous scenario for the jury. Could it be that you held his nose, held his neck, and made him drink this horrible concoction, the prosecutor asked? Though Overton denied it, the jury convicted of her murder and sent her away for life. 7 years later, after evidence surfaced that the boy almost certainly died accidentally, the appeals court threw out the conviction and Overton was released and later cleared of charges. Jimenez hoped for the same outcome, sooner rather than later, healthy rather than sick. More than anything, she wants to go home and see her mother and her children. I want to be able to work, she told me, be productive, do things for my mom and kids. She hasn't spoken with her mother since 2005. Estella can't come into the United States, and Jimenez can't make international phone calls. Jimenez hasn't heard from Fidel since 2010, when he stopped visiting and writing. Her children, who are both U.S. citizens, lived with her mother for 2 years in Ecatepec, and then returned to the United States where they grew up with a foster family in College Station. Because of the nature of her crime, Jimenez wasn't allowed to even touch her kids after she went to prison. On visiting days, other mothers would hug and kiss their children, but she could only talk to hers through a pane of plexiglass while they fidgeted and grew bored. As a result, she wasn't close to either of them. In January of this year, Jimenez's daughter visited her for the first time in 5 years. Brenda had recently turned 18, and now that she was no longer a minor, she and her mom were allowed their first physical contact since 2003. For 17 years, Jimenez told me, she'd been dreaming of this day, but when the crowd came into the visitor's room, she couldn't pick Brenda out. Jimenez walked through the room, her eyes nervously darting from face to face. She was looking for the 13-year-old girl she had last seen through the glass. Finally, she made eye contact with a younger woman who looked a lot like her, only taller, and knew immediately she'd found her daughter. The two fell into each other's arms. Nothing prepared me for that, said Jimenez. I could finally touch her. I can't even describe how I felt. Sat around talking like two long-lost friends, Brenda and Rosa. Brenda told her mother that she always thought of her as a rose. Then she showed her two rose tattoos, one near her heart. Over the past year, one of Jimenez's most frequent visitors has been Gaja, now 45, who is hard at work finishing up a sequel to Mi Vida Dentro. After that film came out, Gaja made another movie, but she told me she couldn't get Jimenez out of her head. So in 2018, she started filming again. I wanted to show who she is and how you spend 17 years of your life in a place you can't get out of, Gaja said. Injustice affects people's lives. It breaks families. It prevents a mother and her children from having the experience of being a mother and her children. Gaja hopes the new film will be released early next year. Before Gaja started filming again, a friend had warned her that prison changes people, makes them hard, especially inmates holding a grudge. But Gaja found Jimenez to be the same person she'd been back in 2004. Her kindness, her smile, her tears of pain at not having a chance to be with her family. I've been impressed with how she has handled this. She's very strong. She's found a way to not be sad all the time. I mean, of course she's sad, but you see her and she lights up. She's a beautiful spirit. She has a lot of love inside her. It's a natural stopping point right here, but we're not through with this article. I'm going to come back to this for y'all next week and we'll read this first.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 86 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the June issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the My Hometown section, and this time it's covering Goliad by Clayton Maxwell. Back before there was Texas or Mexico, there was Goliad. In 1749, Spanish missionaries moved Mission Espiritu Santo and its fort from the banks of the Guadalupe River near present-day Victoria to a hill overlooking the San Antonio River. A village named La Bahia, Spanish for the bay, grew around the mission compound and became an essential hub of Spanish life. In 1829, Mexican authorities renamed the town Goliad, a place that would become forever linked to the Texas Revolution. The town was the site of the Battle of Goliad in October 1835 and the Goliad Massacre in March 1836. Historical tales have also always been part of life for Pat Vargas Morales, whose local roots go back to at least 1889, the year her grandmother was born in Goliad. Morales has long put her heart into the community that raised her. She serves on both the Main Street Goliad and Goliad Education Foundation boards, and she has worked as an emergency medical technician for the Goliad EMS for 36 years. While the revolutionary cry, "Remember Goliad," is etched in history, Morales' passion for her hometown helps ensure that Goliad will be remembered for years to come. The Rock House. There is so much history here. Dad would tell us stories, but it was Mom who was really serious about history, saying, "You need to know this. It happened here in Goliad." When we were little, we called the Presidio here the Rock House. Now I understand how important it is. There is the reenactment of events from the Texas Revolution that happens there every March. You really have to experience the reenactments to understand how great they are. Breaking Bread. Our downtown area is charming, with buildings that date back as far as the 1850s. Maddie's Bakery, owned by the same folks who have the Impresario restaurant next door, was a movie theater back in the day. I was lucky enough to be able to go there when we were small. It was 25 cents to get in at the time. Those windows are original to the theater. You can sit upstairs and see the courthouse square and enjoy our little town from there. Shop the Square. We have so many different businesses downtown now, each with their own style, each offering something different. Blue Quail Deli is known for its cheese jalapeno soup. Last summer, our former judge, Pat Calhoun, and his friend Robert Fly opened the best little gun shop in Texas, a very unique gun shop. They have rare and antique guns, things you can't find at any gun store. There's the Ivy Vine, a shop with multiple vendors inside, each with their own personality. Now, some of the shop owners on the square have their residences on the second story over their businesses. Dance halls and retreats. Schroeder Hall, just a short drive out of town, is the second oldest dance hall in Texas. It was recently renovated and now has modern bathrooms, not just the two wooden stalls it used to have. The food is good, and there are fun events there all the time. There's also the Wisachi Dance Hall, one that not many people know about, just a short drive away. They've converted Wisachi into a restaurant with fantastic fried chicken. South Texas Skies. We have plenty of camping. Goliad State Park has camping spots that make you feel like you're away from it all. I also like the Angel of Goliad hike and bike trail that leads from town out to the Presidio, ending at the grave of Colonel Fannin. It's a nice 2.5-mile walk. Pulling Together. I go to the Immaculate Conception Catholic Church. At our Knights of Columbus barbecue fundraisers, the Lutherans come. We all support each other. For family burials, people are fed. People are grateful in our little community. If you need help, people will find help for you. Downtown is suffering right now because of the coronavirus, but our little grocery store has been a lifesaver. We started a group called Masks for Heroes. On Saturday night, we sewed 250 masks for first responders. I love my community. When something tragic happens, we pull together. Now here's some trivia about Goliad. Its population is 1,976. It has two stoplights. It was founded in 1749. The nearest city is San Antonio, 90 miles northwest. And its marquee events include the reenactment of the Goliad Massacre, which is the last weekend in March. And now our next article, Rodeo as Religion. Cowboys and Cowgirls Show Their Stuff at the West of the Pecos Rodeo, by Christian Wallace. Ask any West Texas cowboy where the world's first rodeo was held, and you'll get the same answer, Pecos. Probably adding under his breath, "You dummy." In the late 1800s, Pecos was a bustling supply town, positioned right where the Chisholm Trail, Goodnight Loving Trail, and Butterfield Overland Mail Route crossed on the dusty Trans-Pecos Plains, roughly 100 miles southwest of Midland. The story goes that a couple of cowpokes met for a drink at Red Newell's Saloon. They decided to organize a friendly competition to show off their steer roping skills. Local ranchers put up $40 in prize money, and so on July 1, 1883, what would become known as the West of the Pecos Rodeo was born. At least, that's how you'll hear it told around West Texas. But other cities have also staked claims on being the birthplace of rodeo, and which of them is right remains a matter of considerable debate. To break up the drudgery of working cattle, 19th-century cowboys would often compete to see who could out-rope or outride the others. These impromptu contests developed into more structured events all over the Southwest. Historians have unearthed plenty of first-hand accounts documenting these early rodeos. To name a few, Cheyenne, Wyoming, 1872, Deer Trail, Colorado, 1869, and Santa Fe, New Mexico, 1847. But maybe don't mention this to anyone in Pecos. It's hard to overstate how passionate Pecos locals are about their rodeo. It's like walking into a Baptist church and everybody wants to talk to you about Jesus, said Pocky Rossi, a friend of mine who knows the area well. Rossi spent the last 2 years living in one of the main camps built to house the thousands of oil field workers who have flooded into Pecos since the shale boom took off there in 2013. But while oil booms have come and gone before, the West of the Pecos Rodeo has been a constant source of town pride since it became an annual staple in 1929. 9 decades later, the rodeo remains the biggest social event of the year. That was clear on a Friday evening, last June, as I made my way to the Buck Jackson Arena to attend the 90th consecutive West of the Pecos Rodeo. A good deal of the crowd there were seasoned locals, greeting one another with handshakes and hugs. A few people sported shirts that read, "This ain't our first rodeo." There were plenty of out-of-towners, too. Charter buses arrived from Midland and Odessa carrying dozens of employees from various oil and gas companies. Among them was Michael Pointer, a Rice University alum who works for an energy company in Midland. "I've been to the Houston Rodeo," Pointer said, admiring the straw hat he'd just purchased at one of the booths. "But you're two levels up there. Here, you're right next to the action." Seated on the wooden bleachers beneath a wide, empty sky, the Pecos Rodeo feels closer to its early predecessors than the indoor spectacles of their big city counterparts in Houston and San Antonio. Those are often held in multi-million-dollar stadiums, like the new Dickies Arena in Fort Worth, and boast booming sound systems that rattle your bones between each ride. In Pecos, Modern touches come in the form of a big screen showing replays at one end of the arena. I was particularly impressed to see one old tradition still being honored. Rather than stand on a platform above the chutes, the announcer, a Florida cowboy named Andy Seeler, delivered his commentary straight from the saddle in the middle of the arena. With his dark chaps spilling over the silvery hide of his gray horse, Seeler knew how to stoke the audience. "This is the home of the world's first rodeo, so I want to hear some noise."